So a giant asteroid is heading toward Earth, and you need to clear everybody out. Can you do it? Today we are going to consider ways in which you might evacuate a planet, and we might as well begin with four notes. First, how you do it depends entirely on how much time and technology you have. Second, it's not just about getting folks off a planet. You need some place to take them. Third, it's not just about evacuating folks. Earth is more than just people. And fourth, you also need to ask whether or not you should. I don't mean whether or not you should just abandon a planet and its people to die, but rather that in almost every case where you might want to evacuate a planet, you can more easily prevent or mitigate whatever disaster would have caused the need to leave. Alternatively, you might not have time to evacuate between when you find out about the danger and when it hits. As an example, a star might go supernova. There are no supernova candidates close enough to Earth to wipe out all life, but if there were, you'd only know if it had gone supernova for an instant before the killing effects appeared. What alerts you to this event is what kills you, no warning. Only if you had faster-than-light travel could you detect a supernova and warn people in time. And if you had years to prepare for the incoming event, you could arrange to put a shield between you and it. Some giant gas balloon to absorb it. A heck of a task, but nowhere near as hard as evacuating a full planet's population and ecosystem. Similarly, the Earth doesn't get hit by big asteroids very frequently, like the one that ended the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. The bigger they are, the less frequently they come, and there's a roughly inverse relationship between size and frequency. It takes a very big one to do enough damage you'd want to evacuate in advance, but if you can evacuate, that means you've got spaceships, and you could just drop a big nuke on the asteroid, blowing it up or nudging it onto a new and safe trajectory. Even if you have to use several high-yield devices and want to send multiple ships for redundancy, that's still way easier than moving billions of people on those same spaceships. That's all assuming you've got some place to move them to. Though the good news is that if you have the ability to have made some other place livable for humans, you do have the potential ability to move them there. Even if we had a billion rockets to launch everyone into space right now, without some place to send them, that launch is rather pointless. That raises the triage issue, because we often look at making some bunker to move people into during such a disaster, and doing that here on Earth, but we could potentially move some folks to a hastily built moon base instead. How you pick those allegedly lucky people is something that's very popular to look at in fiction, and we'll consider it today, too, and draw different conclusions, I suspect. For my part, I'm not quite sure why everyone always figures you'd want to make sure you got your scientists off-planet or into a bunker. That's always struck me as missing a key point, but we'll get to that in a bit. In such triage disaster stories, which are older than history, you have to remember you are not just needing to save humans. Noah had to bring along two of every animal, and we have quite a few parallel tales out of antiquity. That's a little more daunting of a task viewed in light of how many species of animals and plants we know of nowadays, especially since outside of a flood, you need to bring along the oceanic critters too. But amusingly, this is actually easier for us in modern times, since you could potentially carry all that in one briefcase. More on that in a bit, too. Returning to our fourth point, about whether or not evacuation is the best path, we'd need to know what the scenario is, the best known being the supernova and the asteroid, but there are plenty more. Most of them do actually have this same problem, though, where evacuation is either not the best approach, because you can prevent the disaster more easily, or just can't know about it in time to act. For example, in an alien invasion scenario, building warships might be more effective than building refugee ships, even though they'd probably get wrecked by an invader, because the problem with evacuating against an intelligent rather than natural disaster is that when they're done obliterating your planet, they can pursue the survivors. As a rule, asteroids don't get back up to chase fleeing ships. It's an amusing aspect about the difficulties of hiding things in space that the most covert way to send ships out is to send them in the general direction of the oncoming enemy, since you can at least point the engine away from them, since that's the easiest part to detect and use to determine their vector. If you send a bunch of scouts out that double as colony ships, spread over a wide angle, the ones that do get intercepted at least give you intelligence on who is approaching from what angle, and how many of them there are. Also, unlike our intuition from down on the ground, it's actually way harder to chase someone fleeing generally towards you than away from you, since you have to stop and turn around, which takes huge amounts of time and energy. Whereas someone fleeing away from you only requires you to tell part of your fleet not to slow down and to alter their heading a bit. Space combat is often rather counterintuitive, as we saw in the Space Warfare episode, and interstellar conflicts more so, as we'll see in the Interstellar Warfare episode next month. Another popular one is that a black hole hits a planet or gets made in a lab and starts eating it. If an actual stellar mass black hole comes coasting into our system, and they often do, since they frequently get ejected at high speed from where they were made, there's not much you can do but evacuate. That's insanely improbable. Space is huge and black holes are very uncommon, and the odds of one entering our solar system on a direct path for Earth is ridiculously slim. But they don't have to hit us to wreck the solar system or to chuck Earth right out of the solar system. We will save that case as an actual example of an evacuation, since moving your entire planet through interstellar space, if your star is getting ready to die, is one approach you can use. The one made in a lab, though, is not really a case for concern. You could hypothetically make a black hole in a lab. The most frequent method proposed is a Kugelblitz black hole, something we've discussed a lot as a possible type of power plant or spaceship engine. Those who remember that discussion know that small black holes don't live long, and are so tiny it's nigh impossible to stuff matter into them, exactly backwards of the usual perception of them chewing everything up. Most behavior of black holes is strictly theoretical, but if the current preferred theories are right, a lab-grown black hole would just oscillate through the planet, so small it cheerfully flew through dense rock without hitting anything, until it died. Even a decently big one, massing in around a mountain that someone made in another system and shot at us, would just fly right through the planet, as it's only as big as an atomic nuclei, but still carrying all that mass and inertia. It would kill you if it hit you, that's a lot of gravity compacted into a tiny spot, but it would just fly through the planet and continue on its journey. You need a rather massive one without much speed relative to the planet for it to be able to get stuck down in the core and start chewing on things, and I don't think we actually have to worry about scientists accidentally crunching an entire moon into a black hole on Earth's surface. Moons are terribly hard to get into a laboratory. Depending on the size of the black hole, if you just teleported one in there, you could either all be killed 20 milliseconds later when its gravity, which travels at light speed, reaches the surface of the planet and shreds everyone from tidal forces, or it could just sit there for millions of years chewing up matter. There are very compact and small artificial ones, as mentioned, that are actually quite hard to stuff matter into faster than they spew Hawking radiation out, which at just the right size would create an equal outward pressure causing nothing to happen. That is an example of when you might have a doomed planet that you can do nothing about but have plenty of time to prepare for, even if it is absurdly improbable. And that's a key point, because again, in most of these scenarios, if you've got time to evacuate, and the capacity to do so, you typically have the ability to prevent or otherwise remedy the disaster you are facing. Someone lets loose a virus or organism that is killing off your ecosystem, so you need to find a new planet and terraform it. Sounds good, but it's a lot easier to dome over and sterilize some places to be safe from it, at which point you can sterilize your planet and re-terraform it, rather than do that for another planet. And if you can't isolate the organism to prevent it getting into your domes, I'm not quite sure how you'd isolate it from getting into your spaceships and terraforming equipment and just infecting that new planet. Now, the episode is about evacuating the planet, any planet, not just Earth, though that's our main focus, and I wouldn't consider it much of an evacuation if you're only getting off a tiny seed to plant elsewhere. If a hurricane hits some city, we don't evacuate it by grabbing one busload of breeding-age residents. Still, let's discuss that scenario and triage. You've got a bunker that will survive the impact or a spaceship that can carry off some folks to a moon base or space station. Fair enough, and it's better than nothing. But for some reason, folks always want to fill these with our best and brightest. Which makes sense, but the criteria seems a bit weird if it's including Nobel Prize-winning theoretical scientists, which for some reason seems to be the folks nobody argues about. Maybe because it's science fiction, so folks just figure the science is important. Refugees don't need theoreticians. You won't be getting any new science done for many generations, and they'll need to relearn it from books anyway, which takes up a lot less resources and space, especially digitized. You also probably don't need to keep such projects secret. I'm sure you would get a fair number of folks turned nihilistic and causing problems, but I don't think it would be as bad as we often see in films about such impending disasters. Anyway, even despotic governments tend to leak secrets like a sieve, and your typical democracy is so bad at keeping things like that quiet, I'd be impressed if they managed to keep it hushed for more than a few days. So you might as well take advantage of the options presented by an informed public to build bigger and better ships or bunkers, because it's not like you'd have a choice. Any form of evacuation or bunkering up is going to involve a lot of hard choices, of course. It is fundamentally a type of triage. You have to figure out what you can do before deciding what you can include. Ideally, you want a nice, fortified, and well-stocked fallout shelter in your basement, complete with copies of important reference text. But if you've got an hour to prepare for a nuclear war, building bookshelves down in your basement isn't a good use of time. How do you pick people? Lotteries are a popular option, but that's always struck me as a bit cowardly. Just a way to alleviate guilt at having to come up with a selection method and apply it. So you can tell people who don't get into the bunker, fate screwed you, not me. One modern advantage we do have, though, is that we don't have to select people for their genetics or romantic preference, because we don't have to rely on traditional means of repopulation. By default, under that, you want as big and healthy a genetic pool as you can, and preferably with most kids having half rather than full-blooded siblings. We can artificially inseminate women or even implant fertilized embryos of folks who aren't going into the bunker, so you are probably more interested in parenting skills of a person than if they've got good genes. Romantic preferences or genetic defects cease being a vital consideration. You still have plenty of others, and expertise in a given field is never going to be the sole criteria. You want to know what other skills they have. Their age matters too. What if they are married? Are you looking at their spouse's skills, as they are essentially a package? What about their kids? You have to include families, not just because you need them, but because the end of the world is going to be rough on anyone's mind. Unless they're a sociopath, maybe, but I don't think you'd want to repopulate off a bunker full of sociopaths. And making someone face doomsday with their spouse or children left outside is likely to result in folks so consumed by grief they can't function. It's not a choice I'd ever want to make, so I don't know what criteria I'd design if it were up to me, but feel free to discuss it in the comments section below. I'd be curious what folks come up with. Of course, it also depends on how long you need to bunker up and what you're bunkering up against. If you've got to last a century, your profile looks a lot different than if it's just a few years. You're not selecting in the formal for parenting skills because you aren't repopulating off those initial people, just maintaining. It will be their great-grandchildren doing the repopulating. We are not stocking a bunker on Earth, of course, but one built here is going to be a good place to ride out any disaster that doesn't kill the whole planet. Easier to rebuild out of bunkers here than on the Moon or Mars, even ignoring that building and stocking those bunkers here is much easier. So there's a lot of levels to evacuation, and what you can do relies as much on your technology and preparation times as what the specific threat is. To answer the obvious question, though, yes, we could get enough people off Earth to the Moon with modern technology in a fashion that would probably let them survive. Saving our records and even our ecology is ironically now the easiest part of that endeavor. It's not Noah's cargo that you need a big ship to preserve nowadays. It's enough equipment to support Noah's family to preserve some working intelligence to revive stuff later on. We can actually store DNA digitally and print stuff these days, and frozen embryos don't take up much room, nor is it that hard to keep them frozen on the Moon. So even if a species does go extinct in such a disaster, you have a chance to bring it back, if you have the DNA, sort of like in Jurassic Park, which is our Audible Book of the Month. We'll be examining how you go about resurrecting species, even if you don't have their complete DNA, in 2 weeks, along with examining some of the concepts from that novel. Needless to say, digital copies of all our history, art, and literature, even including many redundant backups, and a lot of material that probably isn't vital to humanity's continuance, won't take up much space. Fundamentally, the challenge there is making sure you have a self-sustaining colony or base. Everything else is the same as setting up a normal off-world colony, except there's no one to call on from home for help with problems or resupply or rescue. All the stuff you need to revive humanity, our civilization, and Earth's ecosystem, though, is pretty easy to pack along. It would be a heck of a challenge to set up a Moon or Mars base, and one big enough to be self-sustaining, but if it is priority number one for the entire planet, or even just one large nation, it is pretty doable even amid the chaos and economic collapses you'd expect to be going on. Remember, NASA's budget runs about 1/1000th of the US GDP, and we rarely bulk produce the stuff it needs and try to gold plate everything. In a scenario like this, you aren't building one or two of something, you're milling out thousands of them, and you don't care if 1 in 10 explodes on the pad if it lets you produce twice as many with the same efforts. I would not want to place a wager on their success with such a venture. Trying to get a moon base for hundreds of people ready in maybe a couple years, designed so that they could support themselves and repair and expand it too, but I wouldn't call it hopeless odds either, and it's not like you have anything to lose by trying. As technology improves, this gets easier, and you can get a bit more ambitious too, but I would say this is the last century where humanity faces any risk of extinction by a non-intelligent agency. We've only just gotten into the game, so our current hand happens to be rather poor, but we are at least in the game nowadays. We'd have a chance of salvaging our civilization even if the planet was going to be destroyed, if we had some forewarning. Jump ahead in time, maybe even just a few decades, and extinction from any sort of natural disaster should be off the table. As I said though, an evacuation is not the same as evading extinction. The goal of an evacuation is to get at least a large percentage of your people out of any area safely, and preferably all of them and their stuff too. So what would it take to achieve that? What technologies would we need to evacuate every single person, or nearly so, along with a lot of our most prized trinkets and living rather than frozen samples of our ecology? Now, if your civilization is big enough, like if you lived inside a Dyson swarm, evacuation is easy enough. Such a civilization wouldn't notice or be hampered by several billion refugees any more than a major modern nation would be by a single person. They've got billions of ships lying around. Actually, they probably build that many every day. And their challenges aren't getting people off and housed, but how to cram the pyramids into a bulk cargo lifter and which habitats are offering to store them. At that scale, you aren't trying to rescue people. You are trying to figure out how to peel chunks of the plant's crust off and stick them in some ring habitat without wrecking them in the process by keeping the gravity pointing in about the right direction and strength. I'll come back to that in a bit. Also, if you are surprised I'm suggesting wholesale transport of entire strips of the planet's surface, welcome to SFIA, since this is obviously your first visit here. We don't really know the meaning of over the top. As is often the case though, the hidden problem here is actually heat. If you want to get everybody off a planet in, say, a month, that would mean transporting a couple hundred million people a day, not even including any other cargo. You might have a near-endless supply of spaceships, most of which are probably not designed for landing on planets either, but the sheer heat of all those things undergoing re-entry and then blowing out millions of tons of super-hot propellant to get back to orbit might kill everyone from the sheer heat they give off. To avoid that, and the problem that most of these ships probably aren't meant for landing on planets or leaving them, you need to be employing one of the options we looked at in the Upward Bound series last year. Space elevators or skyhooks and mass driver combinations, or preferably orbital rings. The good news is anybody with an existing fleet big enough to move a planetary population probably has those already. Now, you don't necessarily need a huge ship either. Again, it bears a lot of similarities to the concepts and technologies you need for normal space colonization. Humans have a volume of considerably less than a cubic meter. Our density is just a bit less than water, and water is 1 kilogram per liter, or 1,000 kilograms per cubic meter. So you could potentially pack a dozen or more people into a cubic meter, at least if you've got a chainsaw on hand. But if we had the technology to freeze people, or rather to unfreeze and revive them, you could presumably put people into pods of about that volume. A couple meters long, but not a meter wide and tall. In fact, your typical casket is about a cubic meter. So you need a ship that could store 7.6 billion people at the moment. And at a cubic meter each, that is a cube just under 2 kilometers on a side, or 1.2 miles, and massing at least 8 billion tons. Which is huge, and massive, but actually a bit smaller and lighter than the colonial Ark ship Unity we discussed in the various interstellar travel and colonization episodes. It's also on a size and mass range with a lot of habitats we discussed building in our other episodes. And I mean modest ones like O'Neill cylinders, not the actual megastructures like Bishop Rings, Banks Orbitals, or Mega-Earths. So when your civilization is at the point it can build stuff like an O'Neill cylinder, it is at the stage where it can evacuate the whole planetary population, if you stick people into cryo or some other stasis. You wouldn't have to build much bigger to include everyone's pets and most priceless heirlooms, and the ecosystem preservation is easier. There may be a billion species, but only a small percent of that are large creatures. You don't need a lot of space for a sack of redwood seeds or frozen ants or bacteria. For most of the large critters, you do need parents, even if you've got artificial wombs to gestate embryos in. But not a lot. You do not need 1,000 frozen elephants, just frozen embryos to implant in a few. There's no genetic bottlenecking if the mother isn't related to the infants she's bearing and raising, nor they to each other. Of course, carting a blue whale into orbit is likely to be an interesting exercise, but by mass and volume, they are only the equivalent of a couple thousand humans, and you need storage for 7 billion. Needless to say, you don't freeze everyone. The unfrozen, as many as you can support, are going to be busy building up support infrastructure and habitats so we can start unfreezing people and organisms, the former of whom will go right to work building more structures and habitats. By the way, if you're curious, the total biomass of Earth is somewhere in the trillions of tons region. Nobody's got a terribly good estimate on the actual wet weight of all total life forms, but it should be on an order of about 1,000 times what humanity is. So if you wanted to rescue every organism, not just the species, your big frozen corpse cube needs to be about 10 times wider. If the mega freezer seems too big, you can always just decapitate everyone. We normally only freeze the heads these days. And generally speaking, the tech needed to revive people is pretty much the same needed to regrow bodies anyway. This is the first state at which I'd say you could rescue all the people on Earth. And it does require a pretty bulky orbital ring to pull it off fast. And obviously the technology to revive people from cryo. But I would guess on both being on the table before this century is out. The latter is actually harder, but you technically only need the technology to safely freeze those folks, and that would be an example where you'd want your scientists in that field to be among the best and brightest you saved, or in this case, did not turn into a popsicle. You can't store people indefinitely in cryo, though we don't know for how long yet, and it would depend on your technology. So building places to put them and feed them when you revive them and making sure you have the tech to do so is obviously your focus after that. Another possible route is to abandon biology altogether. As we discussed in the Hidden Aliens episode, if you manage to figure out how to scan and upload minds to live digitally, storage of those minds is actually not a big issue. As we discussed with mind backups in Digital Death some months back, we don't know quite how much memory is needed to store a brain, but the lower-end values make it in the affordable zone with modern tech, and even the high-end estimates were viable. I discourage folks from assuming computers and all their associated components will just keep getting better at an exponential rate, but I'd feel pretty comfortable assuming in a few decades we could do at least an order of magnitude or two better, and that ought to be more than enough to cram everybody's brain on a hard drive a lot more compact than a frozen body or even a head. That's assuming commercial hard drives. We can store data a lot more compact than that already, but for this kind of operation, cheap bulk production is the important part. Those are the early, cheap, and dirty ways to evacuate a planet. And again, I'd be rather surprised if that was outside our ability going into the 22nd century. There are quite a few other options if one or more of those techs turns out to be way harder than we think, but that strikes me as the most plausible route. Going further into the future, if you want to avoid digital uploading, the key thing is having places to put people that can support them, that already exist, and can rapidly expand their hydroponics and air and water recycling. Keep going further ahead, and people will be talking not about evacuating the people from the planet, but the planet from the planet. It's an insane exercise in energy expenditure to try lifting up a few square kilometers of forest along with the dirt the roots are in. You'd need to dome over and under and on the sides like a big terrarium, then lift that thing into orbit, probably on huge super strong tethers between orbital rings, since the heat released by whatever mega rockets you were using would roast everything nearby. Yet the actual big trick is maintaining the gravity in that area. As you lift it up into space, though not into orbit, gravity will drop a little from the altitude, but it would cease entirely if you're orbiting, of course. Then you need to take those tethers and swing the chunk of landscape in a circle to provide centrifugal spin, which the tethers can handle since it's the exact same force gravity was previously exerting on them. Trying to do that while keeping apparent gravity at about the same strength and direction is probably not going to work too well, but you ought to be able to do it without everything falling over or flying sideways. I'd say it's more trouble than it's worth, but if your civilization is actually doing this in the first place, you've probably got very different relative values, and we have gone to some pretty extreme lengths to move large, bulky human relics around safely. Obviously, a lot easier if you've got access to something like artificial gravity, but as usual, I'm trying to limit us to options inside known science, or at least not banned by it, even if that means rather extreme things in terms of size and manpower. Of course, you might decide you just want to move the whole planet, and that is doable. We've discussed some of the techniques before, and we'll probably do an episode on moving planets in the future, but the big one is that same acceleration and gravity issue once you start applying thrust. Lighting the planet so it doesn't freeze if you need to move far from the sun, potentially through interstellar space, is actually not a big concern in terms of equipment and energy compared to what is needed to get the planet moving. The issue is that a planet, especially the biosphere, isn't really well suited for rapid acceleration, which, as Einstein taught us, is effectively the same as gravity. Move some people on a platform at maybe a tenth of a G, and they'll notice it but be fine. Move an ocean like that, and walls of water are going to hit your coast and stay there till you stop. This is what causes our tides, after all. Now, the force exerted by the moon on Earth is probably reasonably safe to use, and maybe a bit higher, so I will say 10 micro-Gs, or 0.1 millimeter per second per second. Doesn't sound like much, and it really isn't. It would take 3 hours to get up to walking speed, and 1,000 years of continuous acceleration to get up to 10% of light speed, probably about as fast as you'd ever want to move a planet, even if you wrapped it around in shielding and point defense systems to deal with cosmic radiation and collisions. The amount of energy needed to move a planet is vastly larger than what you need to light it if you could no longer use the sun, unless you are going a lot slower, making the trip to a new solar system take 1 million years rather than a few thousand. You'd probably push it up to speed with lasers powered by the sun, and down with lasers some colony fleet had built at the destination, with some very shiny mirror sphere around the planet. But alternatively, you could build a thick-walled sphere around the planet to fill with fusion fuel and provide shielding. Hollow spheres exert no net gravity on things inside them, so it can be as massive as you need without bothering Earth, though you would need to use a lot of active support to keep that sphere a sphere and transmit that pushing force around evenly. But that's your final option if you want to evacuate the whole planet in a very literal sense. Just pack up and move to another solar system. Everything we discussed today is pretty extreme, even if the degree of difficulty between the options is immense, mountains next to molehills, but is inside the realms of known science. Obviously, other technologies might make it much easier, but we can see that as immense as the task is, it is actually doable. You can evacuate Earth if you need to. Next week, we will be looking at various cosmological theories for the fate of the universe, from heat death to the Big Rip or Big Crunch and many others. As it's a longer topic, we will be doing a two-parter and we'll be joined by astrophysicist Paul Sutter, with part two over on his channel immediately following part one. The week after that, we will explore the notion of resurrecting dead species and some novel approaches to ecological preservation. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. And if you enjoyed this episode, please hit the like button and share it with others. You can also support our content over on Patreon. Until next time, thanks for watching, and have a great week.